is January 7th.
Right.
Exactly.
What's that?
Yeah,
we got
out.
Is it?
I lost it.
Today's the 7th. Introduction to Jewish philosophy. We're still doing, finishing up the philosophy of the Ora Lora. Today, we are finishing the Talmudic and Midrashic sources that represent the point of view of Svara. That'll take us half an hour, 45 minutes. And the other half of the class, we are going to begin the later sources, medieval sources, that represent this approach of Svara. If you remember, the overview of this year, this semester, excuse me, was that we first did Talmudic and Midrashic sources representing the point of view of Shmua, and then we saw medieval sources representing that point of view, namely Rebbe Yehuda Levi and the Rambam. After that, we did the Talmudic and Midrashic sources representing the point of view of Svara. We're finishing that today in the first 40 minutes, and then we're going to go on for the second half of this class and the next class to see two or three medieval and modern sources on the same subject of Svara. Today, in the second half of the class, we'll see the Maharal of Prague, a medieval source. And the next time, we will go on to see Rav Kook, Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, who is probably the strongest representative of this approach of Svara, as opposed to the approach of the Rambam and Rebbe Delevi, the approach of Shmua. So, where are we exactly? We're at the very, very end of the booklet that everyone has, the booklet of Talmudic and Midrashic sources on Svara. And I'm just going to count down from the end, because we're very near the end. We're almost finished. We're going to finish right now, another half an hour. The last page is 25, and then you have 24, and then you have 23 on page 23.
Have you got an extra copy? Because I wasn't there.
Oh, I didn't bring it. I'm sure that you have. We've been using this for the past six...
No, I haven't.
No, he's got a different book.
I've got my different book.
So you just have to look up. I didn't bring any extras this time.
Okay.
So we're on page 23. Does everyone have that?
Yes.
No, not yet. It's the very, very end.
Midrash 8 or Midrash 9?
It says Mishnah 8 and Mishnah 9.
Yeah, Mishnah 8.
Yeah, okay? Here we go. The subject here of this Mishnah in Tractate Rosh Hashanah is Kiddush HaChodesh, the sanctification of the new moon. It works as follows. The Jewish calendar is a lunar calendar, which means that every month is simply the cycle of the moon. How does it cycle? The beginning of a month is when the new moon appears in the sky. There's a crescent in the sky, a very, very small sliver. And as every day of the month goes on, it gets larger and larger and larger. In the 15th of the month, you have a full moon. And then it starts waning and disappearing until you get to the very end of the month and there's no moon left. You can't see anything. When it appears again, that little sliver, that's the beginning of the month. Now, astronomically, the cycle of the moon takes 28 and a half days and a little bit more than half an hour. 29. I take it back. 29 and a half and a little bit more than half an hour. Now, it's very clear that when we have a lunar calendar and our months are based on the cycle of the moon, every month has to have full days. It would be impossible, not impossible, it would be impractical to have a calendar in which the month starts in the middle of the day. We're not going to have a month that's 29 and a half days. It's either going to be 29 or 30.
So you have a Chinese.
That's a different subject. That's a different subject. That's concerning the years, not the months. In a lunar calendar, what we should have is 29, 30, 29, 30, 29, 30. Every month should be 29 or 30, and it should be more or less in intervals of 29, 30 alternation, and that way you get to the correspondence to the astronomical cycle, which is 29.5. However, that half an hour is the big problem. Because we said the astronomical cycle is not 29.5, it's 29.5 and half an hour and a little bit more. Therefore, it's not exactly that every month is 29, the next is 30, 29.30, 29.30. It's going to be a little bit off. Unfortunately, that's going to make life difficult.
Is it really that important, that extra few minutes?
Yes.
Why?
Because and why is it important?
We miss the moon when we try to land on it.
Exactly. You're going to miss the moon. Eventually, that half hour is going to build up. It's going to accumulate. And you're going to have your calendar not in sync with the astronomical cycle. Okay, that's the background. Now, how does Judaism do it? Judaism does it on the basis of astronomical sightings of the new moon. According to the original system, we begin a new month when we see the new moon. How do we know that we saw it? Witnesses. The Jewish people throughout the land of Israel are looking at the end of the previous month. When is the new moon going to appear? When someone sees it, whatever time of the day or the night, they are enjoined to get on a donkey or get on a boat, or whatever it might be, and come to Jerusalem and bear witness before the court. And when the court accepts the testimony of two witnesses that they say, we saw the sliver appearing, at that point the court declares that today is the new moon, the new month. And when will this be? It will either be the 30 days after the beginning of the previous month,
31.
Which will mean that the previous month was 29, and today the 30th is really the first of the next month. Or it'll be the next day. It'll be that the previous month was 30, and then the 31st day is the first of the next
month.
It depends on the witnesses and the court accepting their testimony and declaring, Mikudash, Mikudash, sanctified, sanctified. One second. Now, just to make it clear, during the early Talmudic period, this system was abandoned because it was no longer practical, being that the Jewish people were being decimated in the land of Israel and it was impossible to maintain the system because of Roman persecution. So we switched to a system of calculations, of astronomical calculations. When should it be? But in theory, and certainly historically, the original system was, as I described, and during the whole period of the Mishnah, until the year 200, and for about 100 years after that, until about the year 390, we went according to this system of the sightings of the new moon. Why did I say all that? It's not our subject of the philosophy of Torah Sheba'al Peh. That's the background to understand the Mishnah we're now going to learn. Stephanie?
No, I was just thinking, sometimes it's cloudy.
Sometimes it's cloudy. That's a problem. Okay, but let's not get into those details. That was just background to what we're studying. So here we are, Tractate Rosh Hashanah. We're in the second chapter, Mishnah 8 and then Mishnah 9. Rabban Gamliel, I'm reading, who was the Nasi, he was the head of the Sanhedrin, had diagrams of the shapes of the moon on a tablet and on the wall in his upper chamber. There is where he would sit and accept the witnesses together with the other members of the Sanhedrin who were designated to interrogate and to investigate the witnesses and then to declare, if it's fitting, the new moon. This is in Yavne. After the destruction of the temple in the year 70 approximately, the Sanhedrin moved from Yerushalayim to Yavne. Rabbi Gamliel is the Nasi, the president of the Sanhedrin in Yavne. These he used to show to the ordinary people, those who came and said, we saw the new moon, asking, did thou see it like this or like that? He pointed to the pictures. It once happened that two, meaning two witnesses, came and said, we saw it in the east in the morning and in the west in the evening. Rabbi Yochanan ben Noi said, they are false witnesses. Now, without going into the astronomy of the matter, to see it in the east in the morning, the west in the evening is impossible. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, who was a local official in his town, and he interviewed the witnesses before he sent them to Jerusalem to be interviewed by the Sanhedrin, he said, these are clearly false witnesses. They don't know what they're talking about. They're making it up, or they're mistaken. They're lying, whatever it might be. But when they arrived in Yavne, to Rav Gamliel, Rabban Gamliel accepted them. On the basis of their testimony, he declared that today is the new moon. And on another occasion, two came, two witnesses, and said, we saw it at its proper time, which means we saw it on the day that's 30 days after the previous month's beginning, which means that the previous month would be 29, and today the 30th is really the first of the next month. We saw it at the proper time, but on the following added night, it could not be seen. That's, they said we saw it, but the next night, no one saw it. How could it be that it appeared, but now it disappeared? Moons don't appear and then disappear. Once it's there, it appears, it remains, and it grows. It waxes. Rabban Gamliel accepted them, even though astronomically it seemed that they were wrong, because the next night you couldn't see it. Rabbi Dosa ben Horkanah said they are false witnesses. How can people see an evidence of a woman that she has been delivered if the following day her belly is between her teeth? You can't say that she gave birth if she's still pregnant the next day.
Welcome back.
So you can't say, thank you, you can't say that the moon appeared when the next night it didn't. Rabbi Yeshua replied to him, I agree with thee. What we have here is the beginning of a controversy among the rabbis. Now, we have to understand what is at stake here. According to Rabban Gamliel, the president of the Sanhedrin, well, today is the new moon. And if this month is the month of Tishrei, then another 10 days is Yom Kippur. But according to Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Dosa ben Horkanus, who said we can't accept these witnesses, that means today is not the new moon, it's really tomorrow. And that means that another 10 days is not Yom Kippur, but it's another 11 days. So there's going to be a controversy here when Yom Kippur is. When do you fast? Now look at the next Mishnah. Rabban Gamliel sent to him, sent to Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua, who is holding the opinion that today is not the new moon, but it's tomorrow. I order thee to come to me with thy staff and thy money on the day that the Day of Atonement will fall according to thy calculation. What we have here is the real fear of schism. If the Jewish people are celebrating Yom Kippur on two different days, that's the beginning of the end. That's two different people. Rabbi Gamliel feels a holy responsibility to maintain discipline here and to have everyone following the same calendar as everyone else. And Rabbi Yeshua, if he's going to follow a different calendar, that's going to be really the end of the Jewish people. So what does Rabbi Gamliel have to do? He has to order Rabbi Yeshua on the day that Rabbi Yeshua would think to celebrate Yom Kippur. You can't. You have to travel with your money and come to me and show me that you're observing this day as whole, as secular, and not as Kodesh, and not as holy. Now what's Rabbi Yeshua going to do? It's a big problem. He understands that Jewish people can't tolerate a schism, but on the other hand, he thinks that it's going to be Yom Kippur. Can he violate Yom Kippur?
No.
What is he going to do? So it says, Rabbi Akiva went and found him looking troubled. Rabbi Yeshua was troubled. What's he going to do? A very, very terrible issue. Should he deny his own personal truth for the good of the Jewish people? He said to him, in other words, said Rabbi Akiva to Rabbi Yeshua, I can prove to thee that whatever Rabban Gamliel has done is decisive. The Hebrew is whatever he did is done. Whatever he did, that's it. That determines the halakha, and you don't have to worry about your personal truth. What he decided, what the Sanhedrin decided, that is the Jewish truth. There is no other truth. What is the proof that Rabbi Akiva brings? He brings a verse from the book of Leviticus. Quote, these are the appointed seasons of the eternal, holy convocations, which ye shall proclaim. Right, the verse there in Leviticus says that it's the obligation of the Jewish people to proclaim the holidays. And according to Rabbi Akiva, look what he goes on to say, whether at their proper time or whether not at their right time, I, meaning God, have no other festivals than these. In other words, Rabbi Akiva says, we learn from this verse, that God has handed over to the Jewish people the right and the privilege and the authority to declare when the holidays are, because the verse says, which ye shall proclaim. So when the Jewish people proclaim it, that's when it is. Rabbi Gamaliel is the Nasi. He's the president of the Sanhedrin. Authority vested in him. If he accepted the witnesses, whether the witnesses were lying or not, if he accepted them, declared the new moon, then that is the new moon. You don't have to worry about anything else. The truth is determined by the declaration of the Jewish people through their vested authorities, through the Sanhedrin.
No, I was just going to add that was an obligation that the people, they're obliged to be to observe the festivals on those days, but they are also obligated to make sure that they have the correct date.
So obligated as far as possible.
Yeah.
But according to this, there's no such thing as a mistake. There's no such thing as a mistake. If there's a discrepancy between the astronomical truth and the halachic declaration, the halachic declaration is what holds, is what determines when the holiday is. God doesn't care what the astronomical truth is, according to this. God cares what the Jewish people have decided. And this reminds of what we had been learning before the vacation. Thank you very much, Chip. Lo b'shamayim, it's not in heaven. God gives the authority for the interpretation of the Torah to the Jewish people. And now we see it goes one step further. It's not just a question of temei or tahor, of pure or impure, of kosher or not kosher. In those cases, you could say there is no objective truth. And therefore, whatever the Jewish people decide, that's what it is. But here, we're talking about a matter which there is an objective truth. If the moon was there or not, that's an objective truth. Even though there's an objective truth, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. There's no such thing. What matters is what the Jewish people decided, according to Rabbi Akiva.
Is there a specific place that they look for the moon in Israel?
No. Whether you live in Dan or Beersheva, Tel Aviv or Yerushalayim, wherever you are, if you see it, you jump on your donkey and you start going to the court.
Yeah, the only difference would have been in time.
In time. Well, it's
by a few minutes, that's all.
No, but yeah. Could
it's
be
a small enough country.
But over a year, that all now becomes the important.
Yes. So now let's go on.
No, but the important thing, the important statement that you're also making, as I understand it, is that authority is vested
in the person,
in the head of the Sanhedrin.
Yeah, that's assumed here.
He's the final decider.
No, but he's guided by the people that see it, and he's got to rely on his witnesses.
Yeah.
Yes, but whatever the Sanhedrin decides, whether their sources were wrong or right, mistaken or not, lying and telling the truth, it doesn't matter.
Once it's accepted, that's it.
Once the decision is made and declared, then the month is Mikudash, it is sanctified. Dorothy.
Remember, by the time the process would finish, even if someone could write in an hour, the chances are that they were going to start a day late.
If the moon, let's say, the new moon was seen at 7 o'clock at night, then that whole day beginning that evening for the next 24 hours would be the first of the month. As long as the witnesses make it to Jerusalem or make it to the court in Yavne within that 24-hour period, as long as it's still that day, even at 4 in the afternoon now, we declare Mikudash, Mikudash, and then the whole day is retroactively the new moon.
Yes, it is. Started because they weren't sure.
Exactly.
Which day was what.
But you can see from what we just said that you might not know that today is the first day of the month until the very end of the day.
But once they decided what the right day was, why do they keep on with the 2 days?
Let's not go to... right? Let's not change the subject. So, I'm continuing on reading from Mishnah 9. He came to Rabbi Dosa ben Horkanus. In other words, it's Rabbi Yeshua now, who's still troubled, although he's heard the words of Rabbi Akiva, and they're very encouraging. He came to Rabbi Dosa ben Horkanus, who said to him, if we desire to argue against the court of Rabban Gamliel, we must argue against every court that has arisen from the days of Moshe until now. In other words, if you don't accept the authority of the court today, and you always say they might be wrong, I might have a better truth than theirs, then you'll have to also go back in history and say every single decision, perhaps it was wrong. Perhaps someone else had a better understanding. But that can't work. You have to accept the authority in your generation. And now Rabbi Yosef Dosa ben Horkna is going to bring a proof that the authority of any generation is the final say, has the final say. He brings a verse. Then went up Moshe and Aharon, Nadav and Avihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. That verse is in chapter 24, if I'm not mistaken, of Shemot. And the Midrash asks a question. Why were not the names of the elders expressly mentioned? Just so 70 elders doesn't give their name. Why? To teach you that any three persons who have risen up as a court over Israel are like the court of Moshe. In other words, if their names had been given, you might say, they're elders because that's him, that famous person, that famous person, that famous person. They had great authority because of their wisdom. But you'd say, in my generation, who are those sages? They're nothing. I don't trust them. I have to go just by myself. No. It doesn't give their names. It's the elders. Because it doesn't matter what their names were. It doesn't matter what their wisdom was. It doesn't matter what their level was. If they were elders, then by definition, they have authority. And therefore, in your generation also, it doesn't matter if you respect them or not, you think they're wise or not, you think that the fathers knew more than them. If they have authority vested in them, if they're given the position of members of the Sanhedrin, then they are authoritative, period. That's it. And what they say goes.
Rabbi, I'm worried about one thing. What happens if it's a rainy night or a dark night where the moon does not shine?
That's what I said.
Okay, look, it's a problem. That's why we didn't accept witnesses from all over the country. If it's rainy in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, it might be clear.
But if it's raining throughout Israel?
It doesn't usually happen. You know, there are so many different climactic zones and so many different altitudes in Israel.
10 miles?
Looks at this climax.
I'll tell you, just to give you an example, you know, I just came from home. I was in the hills of Yehuda. Mm. It always happens, being that we're at the top of the mountain, that we're in a cloud. Many, many days of the winter, where I live in a lone food is in a cloud, you travel 5 miles west, which is going straight down the mountain. The temperature changes, the snow disappears, as the cloud is gone, the sun is shining. So that's just an example for you.
Thank you.
Okay, so anyway.
The number three here.
Number three.
Well, we're saying there were 70 elders. Then it says any three persons.
Because three is the minimum number of elders you need for a court that determines the new moon.
Oh, okay. So this was a quorum of three.
So he took his staff, meaning Rabbi Yeshua, and his money in his hand and went to Yavne, to Rabban Gamliel, on the day that Day of Atonement fell in accordance with his reckoning. In other words, he was willing to forego his personal truth for the good of the Jewish people because he understood that there is no such thing as a personal truth here. There's no such thing as an astronomical absolute given. Whatever is decided, that's what is. Rabban Gamliel stood up and kissed him on his head and said to him, "Come in peace, my master, my disciple, my master in wisdom, and my disciple, because thou hast accepted my words." Okay. So now, what is so important to emphasize here is that what the court has decided is quote-unquote true and accepted and halakhically binding, not because God had any input into the decision. No. God had no input. Rather, we seem to be saying that quote-unquote God accepts whatever the Jewish people decide. Whatever holidays we decide, even if we declare Yom Kippur, which is, should be the 10th of Tishrei, on a day that God really knows is the 9th of Tishrei, it doesn't matter. God accepts, as a word, the ruling of the Jewish people.
In this particular case, we're talking about the month, when it starts and when it stops and when the holidays are, which of course was very important. But the concept here of the decision of the people taking precedent
How far can we expand that to cover other areas other than just calendar areas as far as Jewish philosophy is concerned?
I think we can expand it across the board. And that I hinted to earlier. This is an area that would seem to have an objective truth. And despite the fact that there's an objective truth, still the Jewish people have the authority to rule as they understand. All the more so in areas that don't have an objective truth, like the oven, whether it's tamei or tahor. There's no objective truth, it's just what the halakha decides. And this is an example that in all areas of halakha, perhaps I shouldn't say all, perhaps there are exceptions I'm not thinking of, but in most areas of halakha, the Jewish people have the authority and the right and the privilege and the responsibility to, through our appointed sages, to make decisions of how to understand the Torah, as we've been saying for the past months.
This would seem like a very, very strong position to argue against. Well, I mean, you know, we're saying that we have Shemua, but there is the other side of the story that says that, you know, it has to come down from directly from Moses all the way handed down mount to mount.
Right.
But this seems to me to be almost a conclusive argument that that's not true.
Well, there are two different opinions.
Okay.
Right? Let's go back now to the beginning of all our material, to the unit on Shmua. Let's go back to the beginning. And let's look at page 6. Let's look at page 6 at the very, very beginning.
Midrash Shmos Rava?
Midrash, no. Page 6 is Psikta de Rav Kahana.
Oh, then I'm looking at the wrong six.
Go back to the very beginning.
I just realized we brought yesterday in books.
I see. Okay, so you'll have to listen.
We'll listen.
The very beginning.
Show what it looks like.
We know it, but we left it
home. No,
this is the one, Rav Kahana.
Got it.
Harry has it.
No,
that's before your time.
Okay.
What the Psikta de Rav Kahana says is the following. I'm going to...
Okay.
It's about here...
Discuss 23.
Yes, okay. 23. It's Psikta de Rav Kahana, Bechodesh HaShvi, Piska 23. It's a similar subject to what we're discussing now. It's not the calculation of the new moon, it's the calculation of the new year. And it says that the Sanhedrin convenes to decide, should we make a leap year or not? And I'm reading down near the end of it. It says, the last word of a line, what a God, what a God. He of whom it is written, a God dreaded in the great council of the holy ones, leaves his counselors in heaven and goes down to earth where he shrinks his presence to earthly dimensions. Why this descent to earth? Why does God come down to earth when the Jewish people in the Sanhedrin are intercalculating the new year? So that if the people, the five members of the Sanhedrin, make an error in working out their intercalculation of the year, the Holy One makes their faces shine with the light of his halachic guidance. That's the approach of Shmua. The Jewish people don't do it alone. God is there with them, guiding them to make sure they don't make an error. And that is so, so different from what we learn today. What we learn today is God is not there guiding them to make an error. Rather, they decide what they decide. And whatever they decide, God accepts it after the fact. The question is, where is authority vested? According to the approach of Shmua, authority is vested with God. And the Jewish people, they go through the motions. If they're about to get it wrong, God will make sure they don't get it wrong. Whereas according to the approach of Sfara, authority is vested with the Jewish people, not with God. And God is forced, as it were, by his own decision, to accept the authority of the Jewish people.
I would amend that statement just slightly.
Okay.
Just to make sure we understand. If authority is vested in the accepted leadership of the Jewish people.
Yes.
It's not a democratic process where you call everybody together. It's all in favor of tomorrow.
Yeah, but that's a secondary issue. That's a question of how the Jewish people decide who decides.
Yeah, right.
That's secondary.
No, but it's the authority is given to the accepted or chosen, however the process works, of the leaders. Of
yes.
Designated leaders.
Yes. Oh, Dorothy, and then...
Here's a premise. Until a certain period of time, everybody, most everybody, agreed that the world was flat. God knew it wasn't flat, but he could stop the people from believing that the world was flat. And then an enlightenment period came and people realized that the world was round. And now everybody agrees that the world is round, which it is.
Not everybody.
So?
Anyhow, the question I would have is, how would someone who really believes in the Shema rationalize that people agreed the world was flat and God didn't interfere and tell them it wasn't?
Well, that's...
They rationalized
it. It wasn't a halachic issue. It wasn't...
But it still was wrong. I mean, they believed a lot of things that were wrong, and God didn't interfere and say, you're wrong.
But
this
is
what it really is.
Interesting.
How does someone who truly practices that philosophy rationalize that over an evolution, man discovers things that they were right or wrong?
Let me think about that for a second.
No, but there's an example. There's a wonderful example that's not so old. It's the whole business of Copernicus and Galileo.
What?
Galileo discovers that comes to the conclusion that the Earth rotates around the sun,
right.
And the Catholic Church excommunicates him.
Right.
It was not up until it's less than 100 years that the Catholic Church finally decided to de-excommunicate him, and it took literally centuries before they accepted his position, because their position was that the Earth is at the center of the universe.
I'm just trying to, to have this philosophy that you truly believe in, that God will interfere if you make a bad decision.
That's more.
It doesn't work.
I'm having a difficulty because I tend to agree with you. So to try and defend the other position, I'm having a difficulty.
Yeah, I mean, and I understand their position in a lot of things, where they feel that God's, arm is on your elbow as you write down all these wonderful things.
No, but it wasn't the Sanhedrin.
But there are some situations knowledge hasn't been completed yet.
Okay, I'm going to have to pass because I can't say anything.
No.
I have a science question, and I agree with you.
Okay, let's hear Harry.
Well,
thank you.
The analysis that you made on Pisgah 23 is comparable to the analysis we just studied. That is, Rabban Gamliel, who was numero uno, accepted the calculation of his disciple, Rabbi Joshua, actually did the calculation.
I'm not following.
No, you've got it backwards. You've got it backwards.
No, I don't have it backwards. Look at the footnotes.
Don't look at the footnotes. The footnotes will only confuse you. The footnotes are one possible interpretation.
The footnotes make it sense because it's him and his and who, and the footnotes tells you who him is and who he is and who's on first and who's on second. But it's Rabbi Joshua who actually makes the calculation, and Rabbi Gamliel accepts it, kisses him on the forehead, and says, what are you looking at me so strange? We just read it on page 23.
It's Rabbi Yeshua who gives in and accepts the decision of Rabbi Gamliel. That's what it says.
Show me where it says.
In the last few lines of the Mishnah. Oh, come on.
Well, it's a good thing he wasn't
necessary?
We'd be studying the same sentence for a while.
What the heck is 23?
No, but the other part of the story, one of the footnotes says that Rabbi Gamliel is really expert at calculation, at astronomical calculations.
Okay, but again, that's getting into a different issue. Let's stay on subject here. So while Harry's looking, I want to go to the next source. We're now on page 20.